The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Light of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish thought and practice based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKolel, Dean of the Kolel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture, titled, Is Abortion Murder?, is dedicated to the memory and the Ilui Nishmas Yonina Rus Bas Zev Aryeh Olecha Sholem, Jane Shostak of blessed memory.
Because of the complicated nature of the question of abortion, which is tonight's topic, and the many issues that it raises, when does life begin? When is it a question that it's part, that the fetus is part of the woman's body? It's just her body. She has control over her body. Or when is it a separate entity, and therefore I'm interfering with the life of someone else? When is there a question of who is first? Even if I would assume I have no right to terminate the life of a fetus. But what happens if it's a question of the mother or the fetus? Who comes first? What happens if we know through testing the child, unfortunately, is not going to grow up to be a normal child? It's going to be severely handicapped. Does that make a difference in the equation? So these are some of the issues I hope to bring to discuss tonight. And the approach that we're going to be taking is really I want to go through the source material. And what I'd really like to do is just go through the original source and give you also the sense of how are these decisions arrived at. In other words, assuming we're taking the view of Jewish law, Talmudic law, but still in all, after that assumption, where do we go from there? I would like to begin with an idea that I'm not sure that all of you are familiar with. When we deal with Torah law, we are really dealing with two separate systems of law, not one. There's what we know as universal law, or the laws of B'nai Noach, the Noachide laws. They apply to every human being. According to the tradition of the Talmud, this law, and the assumption, of course, of the Talmud, is that the legal system, at least much of it, is revealed. In other words, there is the idea that the creator of humanity, the creator of the world, who created laws of nature, created laws or ideal laws of behavior. The difference between laws of nature and laws of behavior are that when it comes to behavior, we have free will to create. In other words, just God is a creator. He created these laws. We self-impose these laws on ourselves. But that's the assumption, just understand the system, that is the assumption that this system is working under. According to Talmudic tradition, the first one who received this revelation of law was the first man, Adam. And the basic laws of theft or murder or all the other things which are basic to humanity were revealed to the first man. According to this idea, really, the law that we have throughout the universal law that we find in diverse cultures are really not the product of what we call the quirk of human genius that happens to, in different societies, think of the same basic sense of law, but rather these are ancient traditions that go back thousands of years. At least the core, marital taboos, the sanctity of a human life for human property, these all go back to our hoary past. That's one system, the universal system. There's a second system, which is, we call it, unique to Jews. There's eight, which goes beyond the what we call the universal system. There's a uniquely Jewish system. According to the Talmud, the Jews are viewed really as, and really this is scripture deals with them when it deals with the section about receiving the Torah, as the Mamleches Kohanim, the kingdom of priests. Priests have their own set of rules. The Jews are viewed as the priests of humanity. This is how it's looked. There's humanity as a whole, and we are part of that. And there's the priesthood of humanity. Just like, I don't know if you're familiar with, in a synagogue, the first one who's called up to the Torah is a Kohen, is the priest. There's a priesthood amongst Jews. And there are certain laws that, not many, but there are certain laws that apply only to priests. The Jews, at least internally, just understand the internally how Jews look at themselves, they view themselves as the priests of humanity. This Mamleches Kohanim, this is the kingdom of priests. And this is how the Torah really views them. When they made the covenant to receive the Torah, that was part of the covenant, to become the priests of humanity. It's not saying anything deprecating about humanity, it's just saying what their role vis-a-vis humanity is. In fact, much of the prayers, I don't know if you're familiar with the Kaddish, this is the prayer which in every section of the service we end off in the Kaddish is stated. The Kaddish is really a prayer that all of humanity will recognize the oneness of God. In other words, that we, the Jews, now carry the message. Our hope is all of humanity will understand this message. One of the prayers that are said in the Rosh Hashanah service, it's said at the end of every service, is the Olenu. I'm familiar with the Olenu service. It's also, it ends off with the prayer, all of humanity will recognize that which Jewry recognizes now. In fact, Rashi, and you're familiar with Rashi? Mm-hmm. Yeah, Rashi in his commentary on the Torah describes, you know, the Shema Yisrael. You know, this is the famous prayer, and the Jews went in the gas chambers with the Shema on their lips. The Shema Yisrael says, you know, God, Hashem Elokeinu, God is our God, Hashem Echad, God is one. Rashi interprets based on the Midrash, you know, with Midrash, one interpretation of the Midrash, that now he is our God. Our hope is that he will be embraced by all of humanity. So the sense of, there is a real sense in the liturgy that we are really part and parcel of humanity. It's through the way we live, through the example that we set, that we hope that all of humanity will be raised up to this, not necessarily be Jews in terms of priests, but will fulfill their mandate as human beings and be potentially the human that they were designed to be. Because every again, according to this outlook, every human being has a tremendous spiritual potential. We want all of humanity to realize that potential. So we have two systems again. Universal system, which, as we're going to see, governs Jews as well, and that which is uniquely Jewish. There are differences in the system. And I'm going to read to you a passage of the Talmud, which is the source of the whole idea of that discusses at length the guidelines of these, we call the seven Noahide laws. And this is in the Tractate Sanhedrin. This is in 57b. I'm not going to read you the original Hebrew. You'll have to trust my translation, and I'll just read the translation. And it starts off, it's written in a midrashic work of the yeshiva of Rav. Rav was one of the first of the Amoraim. This is the period of the Talmud. It's his yeshiva that preserved his teachings, preserved the following statement. In a non-Jew is killed, in other words, his court, is B'dayin Echad, is with one judge. It comes to capital crimes in the Jewish court, there's 23 judges. The universal law does not demand 23, only one, which is similar to our system. Ube'ed Echad, with one witness. In Jewish law, you need two witnesses. In the universal system, all you need is one witness. Shelo Bahasra, you don't need warning. In the Jewish system, there has to be a warning. And there's really an argument if the person is well informed, does the warning have to be in place? The Rambam rules that it does. And the warning constitutes, in Jewish law, dealing with a Jew, is I tell you, says, don't do this because we're going to take you to the courts and prosecute you. And if the person says, I don't care, you know, sticks and stones will break my bones. In other words, do with me as you, says, I am still going ahead with this. In other words, he agrees with this. Then he is, after he does this act, he is taken to the courts and said, this is a murder, then he will suffer the consequences. It's interesting, in the normative Jewish system, if the murderer doesn't say anything, in other words, I give him the warning and he pretends he's deaf, and he goes ahead with it, the courts cannot prosecute him. There are, if they see he's a, sometimes there's the idea of martial law, I mean, the courts will impose something beyond the normative, you know, I mean, we don't want murders around the street. But the normal system, we can't kill him. The courts are really only deal with a very small portion of crimes. It's basically saying, you know, this is God's world. You know, I didn't make all these criminals over here. We don't have to do the whole job. We try our best. You know, if we have and we need the proper witnesses, we need to make sure the person was properly informed. And if it's like the Miranda ruling, you know, if we don't have all of this, we can't do anything. You know, God will take care of me. He made them. You know, he'll take care of them. It's beyond us. If there's a real problem, there is another system beyond these two systems. We said this standard Noahide system, the universal system, the regular Jewish system. There's a the Talmud says in several places, one of them is a Gemara in Yevamos in 90b, that the courts have the power to impose loikin, says that they can impose all kinds of fines and even the death penalty, shaloy al pitor, even beyond the guidelines, if the courts feel that really every society is really breaking down. And to preserve society as a whole, temporarily, things can be suspended. But it's only meant to be done temporarily until things are back to normal. Things are back to normal. Again, we have the normative system. Remember, I had a teacher in yeshiva that said that really, if you look at all the loopholes and how easy a criminal can get off, really, the Torah is made for honest people. Now, you get the idea. You know, it says, you know, if you do this, you'll be killed. The chance of getting killed are minuscule. But you get a sense, you know, you shouldn't be doing it. So really, it's more on the books than rather than it's really anyone is actually going to get the death penalty. Now, again, if things are out of hand, then there's, you know, then there's something else. But normally, we assume it's just the facts that you know that at least in the eyes of the Torah, it's treated with such severity is enough generally to stop a person from doing it. Again, we're dealing with basically honest people. It continues on. It says, "Afilu korev." Even a relative is a valid witness. In Jewish, again, within the Torah system, a relative cannot give testimony. A brother, sister, spouse, you can't give testimony. Here in the universal system, a brother could give testimony. And it continues on, in the name of Rabbi Yishmael, they said, that the death penalty applies even for a fetus. And this statement is the main source, and we're going to see another source. And the Rambam, in his Yad HaChazaka, in his work, brings this source, rules this Gemara, that a Noahide laws apply to a fetus as well. And that is the universal system.
I'm sorry, where exactly did it say that?
It's in this passage. It's a Sanhedrin 57b. I just kept on reading the whole.
Well, one thing I forgot to ask. I apologize to everyone. Do you take questions while you're speaking? Do you have any policy?
Well, it has to be a good question.
Apologies to think
about. Right. No, you can ask questions. Just to keep it in the flow of the lecture itself. If I didn't clarify something. What? Right. That's right. There's another difference between the Noahide system and, let's say, the internal Jewish system. There are, I don't offhand know the number, but there are various, there's a whole list, and it's in the Gemara and Sanhedrin, let's say 20, 30 crimes that one would get the death penalty for. There's not as many, but there's a list. The overwhelming number of things that are demanded of the Torah do not carry such a severe penalty. Normally, a rule of thumb, and there are exceptions, just to give you a sense, when the Torah says, don't do this, and it says it in the sort of no, it carries with it the idea that there may be flogging. In our society as we live right now, flogging is would be an excessive punishment, just in our system. 100 years ago it was not. For the last 1900 or last 3,000-4,000, flogging was accepted as a means of punishment. When the Torah does not say the word no, it just would prefer it, do this rather than that, then there are no penalties that are imposed by the courts. So we have different levels. There's certain, the courts don't deal with it all. That's between man and God. There's certain things where the courts will deal with, but the most is flogging. And as I said before, since we need two witnesses, and the person has to accept the warning, it's very rare that even flogging will ever be admitted. I mean, the person has to be stupid enough to do this in public and to accept the warning. But you know it's on the books, so you know it's something which is not preferred, at least. There are, again, this limited list of crimes that carry with it the death penalty. So we have a three-tier system of punishment. In the Noahide laws, there are only 7 laws, basically. And all 7 laws carry with it the death penalty. And with it, there's only one witness, there's no official warning. So it has, again, there are a lot less, but it carries, it goes with a bite, it does, there's a lot less of it. It isn't a regimen for priests. It's not like the Torah itself, like the Jews look under the kingdom of priests, but it carries with it very severe penalties. When we get to Jewish law and we have the overlap, we don't necessarily impose, even in the overlap, the death penalty. For instance, stealing. In Jewish law, you return the object, or you return the monetary value. In the universal system, a thief, if there's witnesses, would be killed. Just as an example, it's sure one way to stop crime, but it's... But there are, in that sense, there is a leniency, not in what you should be doing, but how the court imposes the punishment. That is basically the only discrepancy between universal law and that which is uniquely Jewish law. That area. the idea of overlap, the idea that the Torah was made as another structure built onto universal law. There's universal law, which is common to all humanity. There's uniquely Jewish law, which was not meant to take away, but actually just to add another floor to the structure, is based on a passage in the Talmud in 59, in Sanhedrin in 59a. And there's a Rashi that on Rashi's commentary on the Gemara that makes the statement Rashi makes the statement that the laws that were given to the Jews were not meant to make it easier on them, but on the contrary, to sanctify them more, to give them a higher standard. So anything that's applicable to mankind is applicable to Jewry as well. Not in terms of the court system of prosecuting it, but the standards themselves are the same. At least you have this plus the structure, all the other mitzvahs, all the other requirements. When it comes to abortion, then, we'll just get back. We find this idea, and this is an idea that this is the that the Tosfos actually brings as a as an objection. Not here, but there's a Tosfos in Chulin. That's one of the tractates in 33a, where Tosfos asks the question. You know, says that you've made a statement that anything that applies to a non-Jew applies to a Jew as well and much more. What about abortion? Now you know why I said all of this. Huh?
We may have not used the word Tosfos very often. You may recall our page in the Talmud. Tosfos is one of the other fundamental commentary which appears on the standard Talmud page opposite the Rashi, and it's also a late medieval product involving a number of authors, as opposed to Rashi, a single one. Just want to refresh your recollection on that. We have talked about Rashi, so that's what I said.
Right. The Tosfos asked the question, are the Gemara that we quoted before in Sanhedrin on 57b says that the abortion, this killing a fetus, is part of the Noahide laws. Yet there is another passage of the Talmud. Really, it's a Mishnah which is quoted in Nida. Nida is the last tractate that has a Mishnah with the Gemara on it. And there on 44a. It says that if one kills a child that is one day old and is just born, the head has emerged, one for the killing, one may be condemned to death. It's a capital murder is a capital offense. And it says clearly it has to be born. And if it's not born, one is not liable to the death penalty. And it says, and here we find a difference between the Noahide system, which seems to be more severe, and the Jewish system, which seems to be more lenient as it applies to abortion. On this, Tosfos answers that the leniency is only in the penalty which is imposed by the courts, but the same rule applies. If it applies to humanity as a whole, it applies to Jewry also. And therefore, Jews are bound by the laws of abortion based on that, because it is part of universal law. Okay? Let me just sum this up. Okay? If it didn't. Basically, we said there are two systems of law. There's universal law. This is the laws of B'nai Noach. This, all of humanity is called children of Noah. So there's the Noahide laws, and there are basically seven prohibitions. There are the what we call the Jewish law, which is what we call 613 mitzvahs. Of the 613, seven of them are the Noahide laws. The Noahide laws, it's the Jewish, the art is an addition to the Noahide structure. It's not a substitution for them. We brought down that the laws of abortion apply to all of humanity. And we explained in the Tosfos that even though the Gemara Nida says the death penalty is not imposed for abortion in the Jewish system, but the standard is still there. Abortion is prohibited. So far, at least the sources that we brought so far are, and we're going to see other sources, but the sources that we brought so far indicate that abortion is prohibited for Jew and non-Jew alike. Okay. This is, now that we're just speaking about the laws of B'nai Noah, I don't know if the Noahide laws, I would just like to briefly what they are. Just, you know, we speak about them. There's only seven, after all. They don't have enough to, said we have to finish the class later. We're not going to go into 613 mitzvahs over here. Seven we can handle, okay? There's an easy way of remembering what the seven laws are. I mean, it's relatively easy, okay? There are three what we call cardinal sins. They're known as cardinal sins because normally in Jewish law, if one is asked, one is, has the dilemma, should he do this crime or he'll be put to death? Normally we say a life comes before everything. There are three cardinal sins, though, that we do not make that ruling. That the sin is so terrible that one should, you know, in the situation, one would die rather than commit these crimes. One is murder. One is adultery or incest. And the third is idolatry. These are what we call the three, and this is three cardinal sins. The other four go with Aleph, Beis, Gimel, Dalet, the first thing of the Hebrew alphabet. Okay? Aleph is called, it's the Hebrew's Aver Menachai, a limb from a living creature. We generally think of the laws of kashrus, keeping kosher, as a Jewish thing. There is a universal law of keeping kosher. And that is, if a limb of an animal is severed while the animal is still alive, before it dies, all of humanity are not allowed to eat that limb. So there's a minimal law of kashrus. That's Aleph is the aver, which is the limb. B, the bays, is in the birchas Hashem. Everyone, if you're familiar with the idea of bracha, which is a benediction, this is a euphemism. Here the word bracha is meant as a curse. And it's really cursing God's name. It's really cursing God. Gimel, third, is gezel, theft, with respect to property. And Dalet, the fourth, is dinin, which are laws. What this means is really the Talmud just says simply dinim, laws, is subject to interpretation. The Rambam, this is Maimonides, maintains that is the requirement of society to make sure that the other six are adhered to. So really it is, there are six laws in the book. The seventh law is make sure that the other six are adhered to. Ramban, that's Nachmanides. I don't know if we mentioned Nachmanides. Yeah. Nachmanides maintains that it is the whole system of civil law. It's not just theft, torts, you know, property damage. It's all that goes into a legal system that every society must have. And that's what you're doing in this college now. This is the fulfillment of dinim, this law. There's another interpretation that it means to set up just a whole court system, to make sure there are courts, that there's a there's law and order. Not so much to prosecute this law, that law, or the other law. Just to make sure we have civil servants, we have courts, we have officers of the court.
How's that different from the Ramban?
Yeah. So the Ramban would be personal responsibility. In other words, if I by accident, if by drive, I don't want to say me, but you know, if somebody driving damaged somebody else's car, it happens. Rarely, of course. Then the onus would be that he would have to pay. You know, the other, no fault. But you have to pay. There is being a living a lawful life. In other words, responsibility. Not so much the theft, you know, of depriving the person, but the idea of responsibility.
This is Maimonides?
No, this is Nachmanides. So those are the seven, okay? So just, you know, I have it on your notes, you know, the seven laws of B'nai Noach.
The other view is to maintain a court system which would enforce those.
Right. Now, specifically. But there is an idea of just having courts, you know, just making sure that every, you know, in the Jewish system, and it's maintained that there's a parallel, in the Jewish system, there should be courts in every city. There's a Gemara in Makos in 7a that says in Israel every city should have a court. In outside of Israel every province should have a court. You know, it's a funny thing about, you know, generally we think of cities as New York, Detroit. You know, I come from Oak Park, so it's fairly big. There's a passage, and it's just interesting to. I hope later, you know, this series that I'm going to be giving are the personalities of teachers of the Mishnah. I hope in the summer, my wife says it's too much for you, but I hope in the summer that I would like to give background information about the times these people lived. And one of, you know, I'd like to go through the Dead Sea Scrolls and what that tells us about the times, about Masada, about the people who, the idea of mass suicide and suicide in general. But one thing I would like to do about communities. What kind of place did these people live in? How many of them were there? You know, where do they live? What kind of countries? What language do they speak? But one interesting thing which comes from the literature of the Talmud itself, there's a passage in Erevin, 26a, that defines what is a medium-sized city. And it comes out that the medium-sized city is approximately a square city block. That was a medium city. So when they talk about cities, it's not, you know, it isn't necessarily all that large. If you look at London, you know, the original size, it wasn't so big. And you look at Jerusalem, I don't know if you've ever been to Jerusalem, listen to the old city, it's not very large. And this is the capital, and this is Jerusalem. So cities weren't, you know, all that. Every city needed a court in Israel. So in the Noahide system, I don't know exactly, it would be city, province, but you would need a system of courts that were responsive to the needs of the community. Okay. So far, what have we? Let me just recap what we have. We have the Noahide system, we have the Jewish system, we went through the idea of what the Noahide laws are, and we went through the idea specifically of abortion, which applies to humanity. And Tosfos makes the claim that it applies to Jews as well, because we have this rule that anything applies to humanity applies to Jews. The Torah was not given as a substitute for human law, universal law, but rather as another, as an added structure upon it. No, it's fine. We get warning signs and it starts buzzing and you'll. There happens to be a source which seems to fly in the face of this. See, when it comes to Jewish life, everything would be so easy. It reminds, you know, and Harry Truman said, it's like, you know, economics. You know, Harry Truman says that he'd like for, you know, through the Office of Economic Advisors, he'd like to hire a one-handed economist. Because everyone he has always tells him, but on the other hand, and when it comes to Talmudic law and Jewish law, I mean, it's like the story of the two Jews that were marooned on this desert island. And they built three shuls, built three synagogues, The one that he davens in, the one he prays in, and the one that he prays in, and the one neither would step foot on. there's a tendency of people just being individuals to look at things differently. And things are not always so clear cut. In fact, there's a midrash. And again, when you deal with a midrash, you have to know if it's to be taken literally or it's only an allegory, just to give you the message, not the actual what actually occurred. But the message is a very interesting one, which is really a guideline when we deal with law. You know, I was recently in the offices of Judge Cohen, the federal Avrin Cohen, the federal judge, and we were talking. And he spoke to I think it was a bar association. It was a group from the bar association, and he was saying that 95% of all the cases that come in front of us, we're basically in agreement. It's those 5%. There's much in law that you just don't see eye to eye. The story goes that when Moshe Rabbeinu got the Torah, he went up high and he was told, it was a question in law, how do you deal with this situation? And he was shown 49 different arguments why this should be one way and 49 arguments that it should be the other way. This is new, but what should it be? And the answer in the Medrash is, it's really what the courts will decide. In other words, we are human. We don't, when you're dealing with Jewish law, the attempt is really to reconstruct what the original Torah was. It's the assumption there was an original Torah. What was it? When we're dealing with constitutional law, we want to understand, but what was either the intent or what is meant by the words of this passage? And we are human. We have failings. We don't see the truth as it is. I mean, we tend to look at things differently. And that's all taken into account. But if we follow the correct methodology, as we take the right steps, we are aware of all the sources. As we didn't forget something, it's not a crude mistake. As we're aware of all the sources, and the arguments are cogent, but yet we still see things differently. Well, that's the court system, and whatever the majority rules, or whatever the court sees in one generation, or what seems to make sense, that is law. We're not required to do more than that. We are humans. They say, basically, as they speak about the Torah was given to humanity. I mean, it was given to us. In fact, there's an interesting interpretation. There's a passage in the Gemara in Brachos in 5a about the differences that it seems to intimate there that God gave away the Torah to the Jews. He sold it, like he gave it away. And the commentaries do when he gave it away. Yes, he gave it away, because now it says, now it's in the hands of the courts, and it's not the same Torah anymore. It changes. We are human. We try our best. We follow the attempt is always as the scientist is trying to understand nature and says, well, what's the original plan here? Well, we attempt. We don't know. We try to uncover what the ultimate truth is. There's the attempt to uncover what was the original Torah. But, we're just people. We try our best and we don't know. It's based on the majority. So there is we as human beings tend to look at things differently. There's a passage in this question of abortion which is based on a Tosfos in Nida. And this is on 44a, and it goes 44a to b. It's You know, just to show you how it goes, as you can see over here, it starts on this page on the bottom and goes right on the top. This Tosfos seems to take the stance that really one would be allowed to terminate the life of a fetus. A fetus is not a human being. Just like we know there's no death penalty when killing a fetus, even though we know there is a death penalty when killing a viable human being once the head emerges. Not only is there no death penalty, but really it should be allowed. The reason, there's a question what the correct text of this Tosfos is, but it's based on another consideration why we will not terminate the life of the fetus. Not because it's actually murder, but rather there's the idea, as we said before, except for the three cardinal sins, everything is set aside to save a human life. Tosfos' position is not only for actual human life, but for potential life as well. One would set aside, let's say it would be Shabbat, it would be Shabbos. One would not, according to the Torah system, be able to violate Shabbos only to save the life of a fetus. One would violate Shabbos. One would push the laws of Shabbos would be pushed aside in order to save the life of a fetus. So even though it's not a life, and there's not only death penalty, but it's not called a form of murder. But yet one is required to preserve that life. Right. So it's not so much that it's the act itself of murder, but really it's the requirement to keep it alive. The difference would be, I see somebody else is going to kill the fetus. Right. In other words, I have to stop them. And there's no more responsibility if somebody else is doing it or I'm doing it. The idea is not the act itself. It's an act of murder. But rather, it's a requirement to make sure that the fetus is alive. Again, in practical terms, when it comes to Shabbos, normally one wouldn't violate Shabbos. But if it's a question of saving the life of a fetus, one would. So if you're going to push aside Shabbos, evidently there's the sense, well, we have to preserve the life. Well, therefore, you just wouldn't indiscriminately sever that life either. But that would be... This is Tosfos' position. It flies in the face of the other Tosfos in Chulin that says it is a form of murder. It's just that, one, we're not prosecuted for that, but for Ben Noach, and thus for a non-Jew, it's a form of murder, it would apply to us as well. And this Tosfos in Nida takes issue with that and says, no, the law has totally been superseded. Murder does not apply to a fetus. It's not murder, but for another reason, we're just required to preserve lives.
In our language, in lawyer's language, this Nida 44 A and B is a concurring opinion. It arrives at the same result by different reasoning.
Correct. Correct. But we won't call it murder. You say killing is murder. It's not murder, it's the value of a human life.
The prohibition part is the same.
Well, it operates as a prohibition by imposing an affirmative obligation.
Correct.
The other...
Correct.
Let me also interrupt with another procedural point, emphasize something we talked about before. Tosfos is one of the groups of commentaries we talked about. Yet, Tosfos and Tosfos are analyzing the language of the Talmud, and very often the language of Rashi. The authors followed Rashi. And the issue here is that I want to bring out is that from this analysis of text and comments of Rashi, halachic conclusions are reached, which are followed by later responsa or later codes. This commentary may be a source of halacha.
Correct. Yeah.
We have mentioned earlier that there's a Good Samaritan obligation in Jewish law, that if you see someone drowning, you have the obligation.
That's right.
Is that similar to...
This would be similar. That's right. Where the difference will come out is the question of when the Good Samaritan law, I see two people drowning. Who's first? Who am I supposed to save first? Right, whatever. Oh, you read the, you're not a Cohen, are you? There is a priority. There's a hierarchy. Who comes first? I have a question as follows. I mean, this would be the... I can only save one person. I can save a mother. I could save the fetus. I'm required to save both of them. Who do I save first? Well, in terms of saving, we'll say, well, I have a requirement to save a fetus. I have a requirement to save the mother. However, it seems the laws, though, protecting the life of the mother seem to be much more severe than the laws that apply to the fetus. Because if I would terminate the life of the mother doing an overt act, that's murder. If I would do it to the fetus, well, that depends on the Tosfos in Nida that says that it's not murder, or the Tosfos in Chulin that says it is a form of murder. In other words, the protection of law, though, seems to be greater for the mother than it is for the fetus. If there's a murder penalty on both, one could hem and haw.
You know, yeah, but there's not a death penalty. Yeah, but still and all, you're not allowed to do it. But it would, the bias would be more in the sense of, well, for sure, it's a question, who to save? You save the mother over the fetus.
In fact, on the Sabbath, in Rashi or in...
Yeah. There's the idea of killing the insect on the Sabbath, or, not, I mean, the notion, the discussion, which is brought, there's a Gemara 107 A and B in Shabbos. There they're dealing with, one is not allowed to do creative work on Shabbos. And killing is a, slaughtering is one as a creative act. But it's really strictly, it's the idea of Shabbos is a day of rest. God created the world in 6 days. There was a seventh period of non-creation. We follow, imitate that pattern on our own life. We are creative. We build. We write. In the 6 days of the week, the seventh day, we're guests in this world. We don't create. So the prohibition, therefore, is a strictly a Shabbos thing of, because it's just a form of creation. It's not murder itself. There's no
Isn't
problem.
Isn't that just an exception to Shabbos?
So this would be Shabbos would be set aside to save the life of the fetus, right? Right. This is what the Tosfos is saying. It is a life of sorts that where I'm concerned about it. I want it to be saved. The Mishnah in Olus deals with a situation, and that I think after we discuss this Mishnah a little bit, we'll stop for the break. This is in the seventh chapter. This is the sixth Mishnah. A woman that is having a difficult time giving birth. In other words, the child is really caught. And it's a question of if it's going to remain there long enough, the mother will likely die. One is allowed to kill the child, to really dismember the child in order to bring, to save the life of the mother. Because her life comes before the child's life. However, if the child has emerged and is stuck, then they are of equal footing, and one does not push aside one life for another life. The assumption, at least, we're dealing in a situation, if the child is stuck, the mother may eventually die, the child will still be viable. So let me kill the child to save the mother's life. I can't do that. The child is considered a full human being at that point. Okay, this is the Mishnah. Right.
What happens if not to choose will result in the death of both?
Oh, right. So that's what I made the point, that we assume that the child will survive. If both will die, then it's not a question of, you know, what am I doing here? I might as well intervene and help somebody. Both are going to die in any case. Am I allowed to terminate the life of someone who is going to die? anyway in order to save somebody else's life. Right? You know, in Yiddish, you know, it's nish poshet, you know, it's not simple. The Tiferes Yisrael, who's one of the major commentators on the Mishnah, maintains that in a situation they will surely both die, you are allowed to kill one of them. He maintains one is allowed to kill the fetus. The fetus is the one that should be killed, because in every fetus there's always the question that perhaps it won't be viable. Maybe it has some problem with it. If the percent is 1% of children born, or 3%, or 5% of children born, there may be a problem. I don't even know if the child's a viable child. Normally, I assume majority of children are viable. It's a viable child. Here, I have the decision-making process: who should live, who shall die. This is a consideration.
The mother is
called, it has a cheskas chayim, it's most, it has the status of life, most certainly will live. The child has a questionable status of life.
Presumption.
Right.
Is there any element of this presumption that the mother can deliver yet another child?
No, that doesn't seem to be the thing. Well, yeah, that's not. That's just we look at it as just two people. But his opinion is, but it's not, again, it's anishta zoi poshet, it's not so simple, but that is his opinion.
Can it change the analysis if the mother has a heart disease or cancer or something, and you know that her life is fragile, not from...
Right, so then let's say the mother is terminal in any case.
Not even terminal necessarily, just something that's potentially...
Right, see, it's in Jewish law... If the person is not terminal, or the person is not in the process of dying, we don't look at the life as like chai yeshua, just temporary life. The person is like, maybe the person has a time, you know, it's a time bomb. But the person is alive. I don't believe that would be the consideration we wouldn't be able to take those liberties. We can safely assume the Mishnah is speaking about the case. The child is stuck in the process. Most of it is emerged. Still, it is stuck. It's a breech birth, so it is still stuck. We don't have the medical facilities right now to save. If it's in a hospital setting today, it will be different. We don't have the medical facilities. What should we do if the child has emerged? And again, our assumption is that the mother will die, the child will still live. We do nothing. Whereas if the child, the head has not emerged, we will intervene. I would just leave you now, and then we'll break. I will leave you with the opinion of the Rambam, which is a subject of much discussion. The Rambam maintains that this Mishnah that says if the child's head has not emerged, the child has not emerged, or like most of it is, whatever it is, a breech birth, so most of it has emerged, if it is not considered born, one is allowed to kill the child, is because the child is considered a threat to the life of the mother. It is a rodef. It is a pursuer. There's a law that a pursuer, someone who pursues someone with the intent to kill, one is allowed to kill the pursuer. He is considered a pursuer, the child. And it would seem there's a question, and this would be too complicated now, there seems to be a passage in the Talmud that seems to contradict this. I mean, normally a pursuer, even if we consider him truly a pursuer, even the child would be born, and if you're the cause of death, a pursuer is killed. And the Gemara asks this question, asks on this Mishnah and all this, says, wait a minute, is the child is a pursuer? And gives the answer, really, it's not doing a volition, it's being forced, the languages of the most Mishamaya Karat Filet, it's from heaven it's being pursued. It's not of its own volition. It just forces beyond its control, or forcing this child to kill the mother. As a result, it is not considered a pursuer. And therefore, if the child has been born, we will not kill the child. But yet, if the child is unborn, the Rambam maintains he's a lower level pursuer. And that's a question of literature. Where do you get two levels of pursuers? Because if you go out in the streets over here, you've got a lot of pursuers. But how do you get two levels of pursuers? And that's, there's a whole question of how to interpret the Rambam. But the Rambam maintains that the only reason you will kill the fetus is because it is a threat. Let's say a situation where it is not a direct threat. the mother has a cancerous growth. The mother must be operated on right now to save the life of the mother. The doctor cannot operate where things because of the fetus. It has to abort the fetus in order to perform the operation. The child is not a pursuer. We're not killing the mother. The cancer is killing the mother. The child's just in the way. According to the Rambam, we wouldn't be allowed to kill the child. Would not be allowed to kill the child. Again, assuming now that even with the cancer, the child is going to be born, but the mother will be too far gone at that point to operate. The cancer will metastasize. The child will just be the mother will be too far gone. You must operate right now. But the child is not responsible. The Rambam says there must be some act of not intent, but involvement as a pursuer to be killing the mother. Whereas according to how Rashi understands this, and this is a quote from the Gemara in Sanhedrin in 72b, Rashi just simply says that just that the life of a child compared to the mother is not a life, and therefore you just save the, just like you'd violate Shabbos to save a life, you'd kill a fetus to save a life. According to that, against in our cancer situation, according to Rashi, you would kill you would kill the child. So here we have two schools of thought. We have Rambam who says, we know for sure the Rambam says that one is not allowed to kill a fetus. He says that if a non-Jew is not allowed to kill, a Jew is not allowed to kill a fetus. And he says, he goes beyond that, the only time to kill a fetus is only when it's a pursuer. And if it's not a pursuer, even though indirectly by killing you will save the mother's life, you are not allowed to touch a child. Whereas according to Rashi, Rashi maintains that we deal with the compared to the mother's life, the life is just not a life. And therefore, the child, the fetus goes first. It's only when most of it is a breech birth, most of the child has emerged, then we consider that as a viable person, then we won't touch it. But short of that, we will intervene to save the life of the mother. Let me deal with, let me just summarize what have we got so far, right? Quickly. We have the Noahide system, universal system. We have the Torah system, which is built on top of that. We have the idea that abortion is part of the Noahide system, and the Rambam rules brings the rules so as well. We had the opinion of the Tosfos and Chulin that the Noahide system applies to the Jews, which is built on top of it. We have that Tosfos and Nida that seems to say that it really does not, in terms of, as a form of murder, however, but just in terms of general concern of life, even potential life, one would be required to save the life. That's what seems from the Tosfos. And we brought before the opinion based on the Mishnah, which just says there's a question of the life of the fetus, the life of the mother. If the child has considered born, then it's considered a viable person. Well, if it's one person against another person, we will not interfere and kill one person to save. We will not kill one person to save another person. On the other hand, if the child is not born yet, we will kill the child to save the mother. So normally we will not kill the child. To save the mother, we will. On what is the basis we brought, the Rambam maintains that it's because the child is somewhat of a pursuer. It is the threat of the mother's life. Therefore, if we have to weigh one versus the other. Therefore, we kill the pursuer in order to save the mother. Rashi seems to state not because it's a pursuer, just simply the mother's life is in danger. Normally, we would not kill a fetus. We will kill a fetus to save a mother. When we compare one to the other, the fetus is not considered a life compared to the mother's life.
And we said the difference between the two opinions is a situation where the fetus is not a direct threat, but an indirect threat. This is the cancer situation. We can only operate on the mother if we remove the fetus. The fetus is not causing the death of the mother. However, if we don't remove the fetus, the mother will die. Am I allowed to remove the fetus? Assuming if I don't do anything, the child will go full term in any case. In that situation, according to the Rambam, I would not be allowed to touch it. It's not a pursuer, and it's a life, and I can't touch it. And according to Rashi, I am allowed to. Just like I'm allowed to violate Shabbos to save a life, I'm allowed to kill the fetus in order to save a life. This is what we've covered so far. In our legal system, before the Roe versus Wade decision, it was common to allow an abortion in three situations. When it threatens the life of the mother, which we've brought this discussion with Rashi and the Rambam and the Mishnah and Olos. In cases of rape, incest, and the possibility, which is if it would have an adverse mental effect on the mother, at least that's discussion in law. What happens if the mother will go crazy? In this situation, it's especially if it how would Jewish law look at those situations? Again, according to Jewish law, the situation after the ruling, that the permissiveness does not fall into the guidelines that we've discussed. To save the mother does fall into the guidelines, at least partially. How do the other ones fall in? The fact that normally, like we said about the desert island, two people, three shuls. You know, there's always another opinion. But the majority opinion is that a child of incest, a child of rape, is a child. It's a human being. It's entitled to a life like any other human being, in terms of the life itself. Really, the question of, well, the mother says, well, why do I have to carry it? I mean, which I'm not negating the trauma on the mother's part. I mean, we're just saying, it's a tough situation. We're not negating Nebuch. It's a very difficult situation. She's a rape victim. She has a child that's not of her, of her volition, or it's incest. It's a situation where she'd be ashamed. She has that shame her whole life. The child, it's the stigma. She doesn't want to bear that. She doesn't want to bring a child into the world that'll have that stigma. Is that a factor? And it seems from the majority of the literature it is not. A child is just a human being. It's entitled to a life. There is, though, a provision, and again, which again touches this basic question of why is it forbidden to abort? Is it because it's a form of murder? Or is it the idea of just the future life? It may not be a life now, but it's a future life and looking to the future. When is a fetus considered a fetus? When is it considered at least even a quasi-human being? Going back to the Noahide laws, Noahide system, a fetus is considered a human being to the extent that it's covered, protected by law. At what point is it protected by law? There is a passage which is quoted in a different context. But there's a passage which is quoted from a Gemara in Yevamos, and this is in 69b, that states that a fetus before 40 days is considered has the status of just of a non-being. The expression of the Gemara is Maya Bama, just water, and that's unformed. It's only considered formed in 40 days.
Generally, from my reading, just medically, they consider just generally 6 weeks is, you know, let's say, you know, it has the look of a person. Well, then, you know, it's a question of, it's a subjective thing, you know. What happens 6 weeks minus 1 hour, 2 hours? Like, where do you draw the line, you know? In halacha, the line is drawn 40 days. And again, I'm not sure how 40 days works. Is it from minute to, you know, it's a difficult, you know, thing. And how does one assess the time of conception anyway? There is, even after the intercourse, there may be a time that the, you know, we don't know, you know, how long it takes for the mating of the, you know, of the male and the female, of the sperm and the ovum. So there's always that question, when did it happen? There's always that possibility. But giving us the room for this thing, 40 days seems to be the cutoff point. Up until 40 days, it's considered unformed, pre-human. 40 days, it's considered human. Again, let's go back to the rape victim. God forbid. She knows that she's past her first period. She knows that there's something there. Makes a pregnancy test. It's not 40 days yet. What should she do? Well, in terms of the law, the Noahide laws, assuming that that's, well, it's not a child yet. The laws don't apply yet. The laws don't apply. Then there wouldn't be a prohibition of abortion because it's not a human being. In Jewish law, though, the whole idea, the requirement of the Good Samaritan law, don't stand by, save, be active, to extend the fact, even a fetus, even if I wouldn't afford it, it's not a human being, but it's a potential human being, may also apply to even before 40 days. I mean, one could argue the case. I don't have to call it anything. I just have to see the potential there. It's in the process. It's in the... So even if I don't give it any status now, but if I'm not dealing with its present status in any case, I'm dealing with its future, well, if I do not... There's a future human being here. And there is place to argue in the Jewish system then, the Jewish... Save the life. Well... Make sure it's going to be, well, even if it's 39 days or 30 days or 2 days, there's a potential life there. So one could argue then there's a difference if my prohibition is, the prohibition is murder. Let's say, well, it's not a human being yet. Or it's the idea of I am responsible to make sure that the child will live, will go full term and live. Well, that my responsibility may even extend even before. I mean, one could argue the case at least. And there it would make a difference, perhaps, in Jewish law or non-Jewish law, and it's for a Jew or a non-Jew. We dealt with 7 Noahide laws. One of them is don't kill, not allowed to kill. Are you required to save a life? That's not one of the Noahide laws. That's a Jewish law. That's not part of the 7 Noahide laws. That's the body of law of the Mamlechas Kohanim, so the kingdom of priests. That's a higher standard. Humanity is not subject to that standard. And therefore they really have no obligation to save. They cannot take away, they can't terminate, but they're not required to save. A Jew, that's part of the Torah, is required to save. So there would be a difference then of the responsibility of, in terms of the Noahide system, the universal system, of terminating before 40 days for a non-Jew as a Jew. You know, just as simple, we know, I mean, this, when it comes to Shabbos, the Jew, you know, the part of the Torah system is there's a Shabbos. The universal system, there's no Shabbos. In fact, in terms of the universal system, there's based on a passage in Sanhedrin, in a little further on, there's an argument that a non-Jew is really not allowed to keep Shabbos. Shabbos is a day of rest for Jews. Right?
humanity is required to be creative all the time. The idea of setting aside a day and this is the Sabbath is a Jewish notion. And it's really only a Jew. Right? He is really not allowed to. In fact, there's one of the interesting questions which is subject to much literature. You know, it's not directly halachic, it's this tangential literature, which is very, in Yiddish it says it's some geschmack. I don't know if the best, it's tasteful. There's no real English equivalent for the word geschmack. Is a very interesting question. Abraham, according to the Talmud, there's a Gemara in Yoma in 28b, Abraham kept the whole Torah even before it was given. Notice he was a prophet. He knew what the Torah was. He knew what those guidelines were. It was not imposed yet, but he knew what it was, and he kept it. So they ask, well, if he did everything, then Shabbos is a real dilemma, because he wasn't really a Jew yet. And only a Jew is supposed to keep Shabbos. And a non-Jew is not allowed to keep Shabbos. So what was he supposed to do? I'm not going to give you the answer. It's the subject of reams and reams of it's very, very speculative thing. But it is, it's a fascinating subject, you know, about this idea. So there are different requirements. The idea of being an activist and going saving a life is part of the Torah. So a non-Jew is not bound by the Noahide laws. So therefore, if according to this, could very well be that even according to Jewish, before 40 days, one is allowed to have an abortion. And a question of now abortion, if we'd like to legislate, and if because of Jews being involved in the legislative process, they would like to create a system that would be in concert with, you know, with the Jewish view of universal law. It would not be, you know, to create a law which forbade abortion across the board, because then we'll look at it the other way. Well, wait a minute. If she's allowed to have an abortion, and it's going to be traumatic for this woman, why let this woman suffer? On the contrary, she should have the abortion if it's really not a child. And she's not a Jew that she has to worry about what's going to be, that it's going to be eventually be a child. So that's really interesting, you know, it comes out the difference between the two systems. You know, and this, you know, in the case of some of a child which is less than 40 days. The idea of pain, of psychological pain as pain, which are, you know, I mean, I'm not undermining the fact that it's being pain, but to the extent of what is a factor in halacha? Because again, this mother here who just cannot, she's going crazy, is insanity a reason to perform an abortion? Is that the equivalent of a loss of life? If we know somebody will be deranged, totally will not function, then we'll snap. Well, maybe we should do something. I don't know of all the parallels, and I'm sure there's much literature that I'm not aware of, but there's an interesting passage in the Gemara in Shabbos. And it speaks about, there's in the bottom of the Mishnah, it's in the bottom of the page, it's in 29b. About one, it's part, in fact, I don't know if in Friday night services, if you read it in the Friday night service, there's a portion of the Mishnah, which traditionally is said in many congregations. It's the second, it's really a whole chapter of the tractate of Shabbos, the second chapter. And it's a passage out of that, and one is, that one is allowed to extinguish a candle or a lamp on Shabbos, even though normally one would not be allowed to, because of insanity. The situation is the person needs it dark, you know, whatever the condition is. And there is a question, the one is allowed to because of insanity, and the question is, what is the problem of insanity? is because the person is in that state, this depressed state, or that they will hurt themselves, and it may be a question of loss of life, or the insanity itself is really a concern. The person who's insane is not just, in a sense, is the equivalent of someone who is not alive. I mean, he's alive, but in terms of his function, in terms of his life, in terms of his being in a demented state, senishkin leben, you know, it's not real, it's not meaningful life. Is that a consideration? Or is the consideration, forget the fact is that a person will become suicidal. There's the fear, a real honest fear that the person will become suicidal. Will that allow me to perform the abortion? Assuming all the material that we've gotten to throw here. I'm saving the mother's life. Again, if I look at it like the Rambam, that the child has to be a pursuer, the child is not a pursuer. The child's not pushing against the mother, is not rupturing the mother, there's not a question of a pursuer. But if I look according to Rashi, then it's just a question of saving the mother's life. If it's a question of the person becomes suicidal, I can violate Shabbos. So maybe I could, or the argument would be, therefore, I could perform the abortion to prevent a suicide.
Why is he not a pursuer? Is this potential, this birth is what's causing the mental problem?
Yeah, but it's self-imposed, so to speak. You know, in other words, that's not a real pursuer. You know, it's an example. Again, he's as much as a pursuer, the child is born, and it looks like the other side. You know, it looks like a mother-in-law. You know, and she's going crazy. You know, she just can't look at the mother-in-law day in and day out. Nachamol, vidachamol, can't look at. She's going suicidal, you know. Well, is the kid a pursuer, you know? Maybe the mother-in-law, but not the kid, right? So it's hard to say in terms of a pursuer, you know. I mean, the Rambo, you know, model. You know, you just don't...
The Rambam theory seems to be a very tangible, physical one.
Right, right.
A physical cause of a harm.
Right.
So he really wouldn't admit of this indirect.
And he wouldn't admit to this indirect. That's right. That's right. I would like, you know, perhaps, and it would be best, the last 10 minutes here would be best spent. I would like really to answer questions. If you would bring up cases or bring situations here dealing with the subject at hand, dealing with abortion, that we could apply at least some of the things that we went over, and maybe bring other material here to maybe to clarify the issues. Yeah.
I just had one question. We were talking about the possibility of the mother becoming suicidal.
Yeah.
Earlier we talked about Jewish law does not recognize somebody who's not terminal. In other words, if somebody who's just in a bad heart condition, there's a potential for death, doesn't really recognize it as a factor. Well, I would have then recognized the potential for suicide as a factor because the party is not terminal.
Right. When the question was brought before, there was a question of, I have two people here, I have to make a decision who will live, who will die. So in the question of who will live and who will die, both are alive right now. I don't know what the future will bring. Well, you know, each one is as good as another. That doesn't make one a better person or a worse person. Here there's a situation here that there's a death that may possibly occur that I'm going to avert. You know, it's a definite thing. The doctor has, you know, they've attempted to jump off the bridge time and time again. Except they picked the wrong bridge, you know. They just picked the wrong... Yeah. But it's a... But here, there is a definite, you know, possibility here. I mean, the person has tried it. I mean, we see the mental state. It's predictable. I have to save that mother's life. I'm really saving it now. You know, I'm not looking, maybe, you know, there's really a situation here. In that kind of a situation, that may be a factor. I would say, I mean, it would seem from that Mishnah that you would violate Shabbos to prevent that, to keep the person calm. Well... According to Rashi, it could very well be that you'd be allowed to. I'm not making any rulings here, but I'm just the very moment that you could. Right. The Rashi, that's right. That's really what I wanted. In terms of saving a life, there is an interesting a tangent here to the idea of when is it considered a clear present danger, so to speak. How does one define it? There's a very interesting response written by Rabbi Yecheskel Landau. Rabbi Yecheskel Landau lived some 200 years ago. He was the chief rabbi of Prague in Bohemia, what was then Bohemia. It used to be Czechoslovakia. What do they call it now? Czechland. What?
Czech Republic.
Yeah. But Prague is the Czech. It used to be Bohemia. That's where they got the. He was definitely not a Bohemian. But
they all moved to Paris.
That's right. Yeah. They were called Bohemians, and they. It was so dull afterwards, after they moved. There is a question of autopsies. Normally, forgetting about the thing of just, I want to create an autopsy because it's just fun to see, you know? I mean, like in biology class, you just take a, you know, the frogs or whatever it is. So you want to get this guy who died on the street. Let's see what's inside of a person, you know? I just want to, you know, I'm not increasing the corpus of human knowledge. I just want to make an autopsy. There's the idea of kovod hames, there's the respect of the human body. You don't disfigure a corpse. To what extent is this binding? This idea is called nivel hames, the disfigurement of a body. Now I want to not. I don't want to do the autopsy for kicks. I want to do it because through my research I could save somebody's life. Someone's died of a disease. Perhaps I'll see a pattern, I'll see that I'll be able to pinpoint what the cause of the disease was. So that from years from now, and I'll know it'll take a while, I'll be able to discover a cure for people who may not even be sick today. You know? But since I know this is a recurring kind of a situation, and my research will help future generations, am I allowed to do this research right now? It's not a question that something which is parav, you know, something which is neither here nor there. There's a question that if it wouldn't be a question of saving a life, I would not consider doing the autopsy. Because it's nivel hames, there's the honor which is due the deceased. I would normally not be allowed to do so. But is it pushed aside for future generations? So here, the Yecheskel Landau rules in his response is called Noda B'Yehuda, that one is not allowed to. To save a life means there's clearly a life here. There's a problem here. Someone has a problem, but I'm doing research for problems that don't even exist. So that's not called, even though one is allowed to violate Shabbos for Sofek Nefashos. This is a question if I'll save a life. I don't know if I will or I won't, but maybe I will. Good chance. Well, you push aside Shabbos to save a life, even on a Sofek, even if it's only a doubt. But is this called a doubt if, he says, the doubt is only when there's a clear and present danger to a person who is right now in danger. But for me to push aside the laws of the Torah for something that's not here, his opinion is that you are not allowed to. Because there has to be a life, there has to be a saving, the attempt, there must be the problem here. The person doesn't exist.
You posited that the man who died on the street has died of a disease.
That's the situation, right.
Well,
yeah, I mean,
the response is bothersome because if one person has a condition, diseases, maybe, a condition, surely the speculation is reasonable that another human will have.
But till I get around finding the, you know how the medical bureaucracies work. Till I'll find around until it's published and I get in the New England Journal of Medicine, they will have all those who have the condition now will have all died out. I'm making this assumption, right? Again, we're dealing again with a particular situation here.
I understand, but what we have is medicine. The response requires medicine to chase its tail because it can never get out of the loop.
No, well, here you're dealing with a situation which normally would be morally reprehensible. We're not. We want to do. We want to look for our future generations. It's a question of. But this, I would normally not be allowed.
But it's not a cardinal sin.
No, it's not one of the cardinals. But let's say a situation that would follow just a similar kind of a situation here. If according to Rashi, now I just want to take this one step further here, you know, just to see where I'm going here. Now let's take it one step further. If I will disagree with a Noda B'Yehuda, because I will disagree with Yecheskel Lando, I will take the position that down the road I know people will suffer. There's a good chance my research will help them. Person's not here now, but it's a good chance. Rashi says, and this is at least how we interpreted Rashi, I'm allowed to permit an abortion to save a life. Well, am I allowed therefore to permit an abortion to do research on the fetus that will give me information that will save somebody's life down the road that doesn't exist right now? In other words, am I allowed to allow abortion to save a future life?
For that purpose.
For the purpose of saving...
I think Rashi would say that.
Right, so that would be... Right, this would be... You know, if we say what considers a life is and the concerns of life are pressing needs this second...
Except the balance is the taking of the fetus's life to save the speculative life in the future.
Right.
Here, we have... course, and an autopsy to say the enormity of the autopsy doesn't begin to approach the enormity of the killing of the fetus.
You see, but according to Rashi, you see, that depends. You know, this really all touches, is this murder by abortion? So you see, or it's not really not a murder, it's just a sense of, you know, we have to worry about the life that's going to emerge later on. It's really not murder. Like, sinishta zegeferlo. It's not so bad. Well, it's not so bad. Well, we don't want to push aside anything. We'd like to do everything right. But here, there's a question of a life. So how much life is life that we could push aside this thing? So here, we're really now touching, you know, we really have to have firmly in place what our guidelines going to be. What is the question of life that's so important that I'm going to violate Shabbos for, or an autopsy for this? And well, if that thing, then I'll transfer it now to the abortion situation, at least according to Rashi, and I'll say, well, I can abort it for that purpose as well. Maybe. It's interesting, I just wanted how things, you know, it's all one structure. Things like touch upon one another, and how it will make a difference here will affect something over there. What?
Pareto's optimality. Touch something and it's just appearing.
Right, it'll automatically and everything. And really, the Talmud is just one. It's a fascinating system. Here we deal with Shabbos and we deal with this, and really it all comes together. And really, then you have. You know, this paradoxical problem here. You can't know really anything until you know it all. And you can't know it all until you know the sum of all the parts. You know, so you have the problem of... But it is an enormous structure. You know, it's an enormous legal... Which really, that every little part, even you learn something which may not... You know, but it touches upon, you know, enormous amount of things. Let me just leave you with one little thing, you know, which again, it's a... What would be called, it's tangential, but it opens up a whole world of thought. Speculative thought, but it's a fascinating thing. I don't know if you've all heard about Elijah the prophet, Eliyahu HaNavi. You know, besides that which is listed in Tanakh, in the Bible, he is the one destined to come right before the Messiah comes, isn't it? There's an opinion in the Gemara and Bava Metzia in 114b that Eliyahu was a Kohen, was a priest. Just as we said before, Jews are a kingdom of priests. They're held to a higher standard. Priests amongst Jews are held to a higher standard. One of the things that normally a priest is not allowed to do is go to a graveyard, come in contact with the dead. I mean, that's a whole... you know, I only have 2 minutes, I'm running late anyway, so I'm not going to think about why and the what. But in the Torah, except for his relatives, you know, he's coming relative in terms of their burial, he is not allowed to go to a graveyard. We know that Eliyahu HaNavi, Elijah the prophet, resuscitated someone who was dead. At least that's who he's described of as dead. Assuming it means not that he was just comatose, but it was assuming, make the assumption dead means truly dead. If Elijah was a Kohen, how could he revive him? Because the reviving process was described, he laid on top of him, and he put himself next to him, and he prayed, and it was revived. Well, he made himself impure, and as he came in contact with the dead, he was not allowed to do so. Why was he allowed to come in contact with him? That is the question that the Tosfos asks. Tosfos answers, right? And really, and that passage of the Talmud is really an agadic section. I mean, it brought the thing about Eliyahu being a Kohen. It's not, you know, the legal section, but it has to do with the peripheral sections of the Talmud that deal with the philosophy, with history. And it was in that section that it was brought that Eliyahu was a Kohen. And it was brought, Tosfos asked the question, well, how could he revive him? And his answer was, well, since he knew, the language of the Tosfos is, since he was sure that he would be able to revive him, he was allowed to do it. He was sure that he was allowed to do it. So the commentators ask on Tosfos, what do you have to be sure? Even if it's a question, you're allowed to violate Shabbos on a question. Why couldn't he, even if he did know? But maybe he'd be able to revive him. You know, you save a life. Even if you're not sure, go save the life. So one of the answers, but usually if you get the question, says, in other words, why was he allowed to make himself come in contact with the dead to save the life? And the answer was, well, he knew for sure he's going to make him alive. What was Tosfos asking a question? What was his answer? He was saving someone's life, and that's it. And even if he wouldn't be sure he'd be saving the life, he'd be allowed to do so. Why does Tosfos say that since he was positive he would be able to save the person? And the answer that one of the great commentators gives is that there's a difference of a person's alive already and you're maintaining his life, or someone is dead and you're giving him a new life, so to speak. If someone is alive and you're maintaining his life, that where the Torah says all the laws of the Torah are bent to, are pushed aside in order to save a person's life.
Even a doubtful situation.
Right, even a doubtful situation. Here he's dead. You're creating him out of the whole cloth. So he says that the idea that why he'll certainly live is not based, is based, and this is, goes beyond that time, on a whole different proposition, that in order to, even if you'd be certain, you'd be giving, you, the person would live a viable life and be, and do many mitzvahs and do many good things, you'd be allowed to violate one thing in order.